In Ear 4, lines 297 to 503.
But the Queen, who can deceive a lover, knew in advance some scheme was afoot. Afraid, when there was nothing to fear, she was the first to catch wind of their plans to leave. And while she was already in a frenzy, that same wicked rumour brought word that the Trojans were fitting out their fleet and preparing to sail away. Driven to distraction and burning with passion, she raged and raved round the whole city like a bacchant, stirred by the shaking of the sacred emblems and roused to frenzy when she hears the name of Bacchus at the biennial orgy and the shouting on Mount Kithiron calls to her in the night. At last, she went to Aeneas, and before he could speak, she cried, "You traitor! Did you imagine you could do this and keep it secret? Did you think you could slip away from this land of mine and say nothing? Does our love have no claim on you? Or the pledge your right hand once gave me? Or the prospect of Dido dying a cruel death? Why must you move your fleet in these winter storms and rush across the high seas into the teeth of the north wind? You are heartless. Even if it were not other people's fields and some home unknown you were going to, if old Troy were still standing, would any fleet set sail even for Troy in such stormy seas? Is it me you are running away from? I beg you, by these tears, by the pledge you gave me with your own right hand, I have nothing else left me now in my misery. I beg you, by our union, by the marriage we have begun, if I have deserved any kindness from you, if you have ever loved anything about me, pity my house that is falling around me. And I implore you, if it's not too late for prayers, give up this plan of yours. I am hated because of you by the peoples of Libya and the Numidian kings. My own Tyrians are against me. Because of you, I have lost all conscience and self-respect, and have thrown away the good name I once had, my only hope of reaching the stars. My guest is leaving me to my fate, and I shall die. Guest is the only name I can now give the man who used to be my husband. What am I waiting for? For my brother Pygmalion to come and raze my city to the ground? For the Gaetulian Iarbas to drag me off in chains? Oh, if only you had given me a child before you abandoned me. If only there were a little Aeneas to play in my palace. In spite of everything, his face would remind me of yours, and I would not feel utterly betrayed and desolate." She had finished speaking. Remembering the warnings of Jupiter, Aeneas did not move his eyes and struggled to fight down the anguish in his heart. At last he spoke these few words. "I know, O Queen, you can list a multitude of kindnesses you have done me. I shall never deny them, and never be sorry to remember Dido while I remember myself, while my spirit still governs this body. Much could be said. I shall say only a little. It never was my intention to be deceitful, or run away without your knowing, and do not pretend that it was. Nor have I ever offered you marriage, or entered into that contract with you. If the fates were leaving me free to live my own life and settle all my cares according to my own wishes, my first concern would be to tend the city of Troy and my dear ones who are still alive. The lofty palace of Priam would still be standing, and with my own hands I would have built a new citadel at Pergamum for those who had been defeated. But now Apollo of Grinium has commanded me to claim the great land of Italy, and Italy is the word on the lots cast at his Lycian oracle. That is my love, and that is my homeland. You are a Phoenician from Asia, and you care for the citadel of Carthage, and love the very site of this city in Libya. What objection can there be to Trojans settling in the land of Ausonia. How can it be a sin if we too look for distant kingdoms? Every night when the earth is covered in mist and darkness, every time the burning stars rise in the sky, I see in my dreams the troubled spirit of my father Anchises coming to me with warnings, and I am afraid. I see my son Ascanius and think of the wrong I am doing him, cheating him of his kingdom in Hesperia and the lands the fates have decreed for him. And now, even the messenger of the gods has come down through the swift winds, I swear it by the lives of both of us, and brought commands from Jupiter himself. With my own eyes I have seen the god in the clear light of day coming within the walls of your city. With my own ears I have listened to his voice. Do not go on causing distress to yourself and to me by these complaints. It is not by my own will that I still search for Italy. All the time he had been speaking, she was turned away from him, but looking at him, speechless and rolling her eyes, taking in every part of him. At last she replied on a blaze of passion, "You are a traitor. You are not the son of a goddess, and Dardanus was not the first founder of your family. It was the Caucasus that fathered you on its hard rocks, and Hyrcanian tigers offered you their udders. Why should I keep up a pretense? Why should I keep myself in check in order to endure greater suffering in the future? He did not sigh when he saw me weep. He did not even turn to look at me. Was he overcome and brought to tears? Had he any pity for the woman who loves him? Where can I begin when there is so much to say? Now, after all this, can mighty Juno and the son of Saturn, the father of all, can they now look at this with the eyes of justice? Is there nothing we can trust in this life? He was thrown helpless on my shores, and I took him in, and like a fool settled him as partner in my kingdom. He had lost his fleet, and I found it and brought his companions back from the dead. It drives me to madness to think of it. And now we hear about the augur Apollo and lots cast in Lycia. And now, to crown all, the messenger of the gods is bringing terrifying commands down through the winds from Jupiter himself. As though that is work for the gods in heaven. As though that is an anxiety that disturbs their tranquillity. I do not hold you or bandy words with you. Away you go. Keep on searching for your Italy with the winds to help you. Look for your kingdom over the waves. But my hope is that if the just gods have any power, you will drain a bitter cup among the ocean rocks, calling the name of Dido again and again, and I shall follow you, not in the flesh, but in the black fires of death. And when its cold hand takes the breath from my body, my shade shall be with you wherever you may be. You will receive the punishment you deserve, and the news of it will reach me deep among the dead." At these words she broke off and rushed indoors in utter despair, leaving Aeneas with much to say and much to fear. Her attendants caught her as she fainted and carried her to her bed in her marble chamber. But Aeneas was faithful to his duty. Much as he longed to soothe her and console her sorrow, to talk to her and take away her pain with many a groan, and with a heart shaken by his great love, he nevertheless carried out the commands of the gods and went back to his ships. By then, the Trojans were hard at work. All along the shore they were hauling the tall ships down to the sea. They set the well-corked hulls afloat, and in their eagerness to be away, they were carrying down from the woods unworked timber and green branches for oars. You could see them pouring out of every part of the city, like ants plundering a huge heap of wheat and storing it away in their home against the winter, and their black column advances over the plain as they gather in their booty along a narrow path through the grass. Some putting their shoulders to huge grains and pushing them along, others keeping the column together and whipping in the stragglers, and the whole track seethes with activity. What were your feelings, Dido, as you looked at this? Did you not moan as you gazed out from the top of your citadel and saw the broad shore seething before your eyes, and confusion and shouting all over the sea? Love is a cruel master. There are no lengths to which it does not force the human heart. Once again, she had recourse to tears. Once again, she was driven to try to move his heart with prayers, becoming a suppliant and making her pride submit to her love, in case she should die in vain, leaving some avenue unexplored. You see, Anna, the bustle all over the shore. They're all gathered there. The canvas is calling for the winds. The sailors are delighted and have set garlands on the ship's sterns. I was able to imagine that this grief might come. I shall be able to endure it. But, Anna, do this one service for your poor sister. You're the only one the traitor respected. To you he entrusted his very deepest feelings. You are the only one who knew the right time to approach him and the right words to use. Go to him, sister. Kneel before our proud enemy and tell him, I was not at Aulis and made no compact with the Greeks to wipe out the people of Troy. I sent no fleet to Pergamum. I did not tear up the ashes of his dead father, Anchises. Why are his cruel ears closed to what I am saying? Where is he rushing away to? Ask him to do this last favour to the unhappy woman who loves him, and wait until there is a following wind and his escape is easy. I am no longer begging for the marriage which we once had, and which he has now betrayed. I am not pleading with him to do without his precious Latium and abandon his kingdom. What I am asking for is some time, nothing more, an interval, a respite for my anguish, so that fortune can teach me to grieve and to endure defeat. This is the last favour I shall beg. Oh, Anna, pity your sister. I shall repay it in good measure at my death. These were Dido's pleas. These were the griefs her unhappy sister brought and brought again. But no griefs moved Aeneas. He heard, but did not heed her words. The fates forbade it, and God blocked his ears to all appeals. Just as the north winds off the Alps vie with one another to uproot the mighty oak whose timber has hardened over long years of life, blowing upon it from this side and from that, and howling through it, the trunk feels the shock, and the foliage from its head covers the ground, but it holds on to the rocks with roots plunged as deep into the world below as its crown soars towards the winds of heaven. Just so the hero Aeneas was buffeted by all this pleading on this side and on that, and felt the pain deep in his mighty heart. But his mind remained unmoved, and the tears rolled in vain. Then it was that unhappy Dido prayed for death. She had seen her destiny and was afraid. She could bear no longer to look up to the bowl of heaven, and her resolve to leave the light was strengthened when she was laying offerings on the incense-breathing altars and saw, to her horror, the consecrated milk go black, and the wine, as she poured it, turned to filthy gore. No one else saw it, and she did not even tell her sister. There was more. She had in her palace a marble shrine dedicated to Sychaeus, who had been her husband. This she used to honour above all things, hanging it with white fleeces and sacred branches. When the darkness of night covered the earth, she thought she heard coming from this shrine the voice of her husband, and the words he uttered as he called to her. And all the while the lonely owl kept up its long dirge upon the roof, drawing out its doleful song of death. And there was more. She kept remembering the predictions of ancient prophets that terrified her with their dreadful warnings. And as she slept, Aeneas himself would drive her relentlessly in her madness, and she was always alone and desolate, always going on a long road without companions, looking for her Tyrians in an empty land. She would be like Pentheus in his frenzy when he was seeing columns of Furies and a double sun and two cities of Thebes, or like Orestes, son of Agamemnon, driven in flight across the stage by his own mother, armed with her torches and black snakes, while the avenging Furies sat at the door.